Do you love Jesus but not the church? Yeah, this is a potentially great article for the year 2018 when fewer and fewer people are connecting in a legitimate, relational, accountable way to a local church. The numbers are just startling as to millennial, Gen X, Gen Z, and their commitment to the local church. I love Jesus, it's Christians I can't stand, explanation point, end quote. The author, Rick Schenck, thank you, says, I have heard this, or something very like it, declared as the decisive judgment which authorizes some to avoid engaging in the life of the church. What drives this sentiment? It is, I think, the offense of the gospel that Kierkegaard wrote about in his book, Training in Christianity. Who found this article?
Nathan.
Me.
Nathan.
All right, where?
Desiring God.
Okay.
Yeah, he's from Minnesota, so he teaches. He's a professor at Bethlehem College and Seminary.
All right.
So probably
he's also Piper. The senior pastor of Village Church up there as well.
Pagan, let's get started.
Pagan Church. Kierkegaard.
What a great name.
Yeah, that's great. Lived in Copenhagen, Denmark, in the middle of the 19th century. If you were born at that time, in that place, you were baptized, and so by law and by custom, you were a Christian. And yet, few people were actually Christian. As Kierkegaard wrote in his book, such a diabolical and cultural Christianity converted Christianity into paganism. Kierkegaard begins training in Christianity with the call of Christ in Matthew 11:28. Come hither with Jesus, he writes. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. But who was the Jesus who spoke these words? It was not the glorified Christ, but the Christ who is all too human, too humble, and without worldly power. The Christ who is despised and rejected of men. And so, immediately, we are confronted with the offense. The offense is the Christ who, in his state of humiliation, uttered these words, from the seat of his glory, he has not uttered them. That is, it was not the glorified Christ who said these words, or who says them now. Indeed, all who sit on this side of the resurrection are too quick to think we can run to the risen and glorified Christ by bypassing the Christ who is gentle and lowly in heart, Matthew 11:29. The clergyman and philosopher, the statesman, the mocker, and even the solid citizen are attracted to the glorified Christ for their own reasons. All dismiss the true Christ as an offense. So Kierkegaard writes, all pith and vigor was distilled out of Christianity. The tension of the paradox was relaxed. One became a Christian without noticing it, and without in the least noticing the possibility of offense. In that way, Christianity became paganism. Yet the real Christ is the despised man who commands us, come. By knowing only the exalted Christ, Kierkegaard challenges, we have deified and established order and secularized Christianity. The crown without a cross. What is this secular paganism? Paganism offers glory without the offense, a crown without a cross. But if we are to respond to the come hither of Jesus, we must come with a contrite heart, grieved, broken, and on the narrow way, answering to the man who claimed to be God, but in no way met our expectations of God. In fact, in a Christian culture, one is not offended by the claim that he is God, but by the observation that God is this man. Yet, it is the humiliated Christ who invited and invites us still today. We cannot bypass the humble and crucified Christ to go straight to the glorified Christ. How is this an offense? What is Jesus asking of us? The humiliation of the true Christian is not plain humiliation. It is merely the reflected image of exaltation, but the reflection of it in the world. Kierkegaard would have quoted Romans 8:17, we are fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. Instead, he reminds us of John 12:32, And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Both texts remind us that we must want to be drawn to the impoverished and humble Christ, the one who is cursed and lifted up. He is the unattractive man who uttered this offer, not another. We must desire the despised one. In his humiliation, submitting to our own suffering with him, will you? An offensive bride.
Are we following him? Because I thought the title was, Do You Love Jesus But Not the Church? Jack, help me understand. Where's he going with this? Are you following him?
Well, when we first started out with the pagan church, the thing that that caught my attention was the remembrances of a cultural Christianity. He's saying, this guy lived, Kierkegaard lived in the 1850s, or middle of the 19th century, so 1850s. But 100 years before that, in the 1740s, America was experiencing the Halfway Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And in between these two, William Wilberforce is writing against cultural Christianity in England that allows you to say that you love God but enslave other human beings.
Right.
So I think what's happening is we got to remember this guy was a philosopher that this guy's pulling from. And in it, he looked around and saw cultural Christianity in the Age of Enlightenment. It was a time in which the idea of theological suspicion was coming in. We're not postmodern yet, but it's the emergence of the postmodern thought that we have to be suspicious of everything. Can we trust that this is the truth? And what we're starting to see is he's looking around and he's saying, okay, wait a minute. The Bible's saying this, and I can intellectually see that, but yet we're living over here in this completely other way that disregards the humility of God. We're not living in a humble manner. We don't look like the humble, suffering servant Christ. We look more like the princes of this nation, of this world, because wealth is on the rise. The merchants are on the rise. So all of society was now beginning to have this disconnect and this but yet we're still going to church. Fast forward to the 1960s. Pop culture, I think, hit it hard one time when a guy named Barry McGuire wrote this in a song. He said, you can leave here for space, but when you return, it's the same old place. You think about all the hate there is in Red China, but look to Selma, Alabama. You can hate your next-door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And it was drawing this absolute tension between the idea of Christ's words, and Christ was this humble guy, and he said, look, I am despised, everybody hates me, I'm homeless and everything else, and I'm telling you, come and worship me as I am in this state and be like me in this state with this mentality. And everybody says, well, wait a minute, what we want is the end game. We want the resurrected, we want the power, we want the inheritance, the ruling and reigning now. I don't want the suffering that is in resemblance of you. And he is saying, and so this became Christianity. And it's the health and welfare gospel of today.
Right, and I don't understand how that relates to his title.
But I think that...
Well, comparing the hypocrisy that Kierkegaard saw to what he's seeing now. And so
we haven't gotten to part B yet,
and that's where it's really going to hit home.
Okay.
But I think what he's going to do is he's going to take us and say, look, this is why they're making that statement.
Mm-hmm.
More than anything else, is they see this disconnect now, and that's why they say, I'd really love to love Jesus, but I can't have a part of this church thing because the church thing is so disconnected from the Jesus I read in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay, an offensive bride, is that where we're at?
Yeah.
Many will say, of course I will. I have. Good. But some who say this, even as they say this, fall into the very trap of which Kierkegaard warned us. You might say, but how could that be? Kierkegaard lived in different times. We do not live in a Christian culture. Not at all. Ours is post-Christian, even hostile to Christianity. I have responded to the come hither of Christ at a cost. Perhaps not. Not if you come to Christ glorified without the possibility of offense. Not if you avoid identifying with Christ's church. You see, while Christ is now glorified, the church is not. And this not yet glorified church is the very body of Christ who calls all, come hither. This church is weak and unattractive and offensive. If Jesus was despised for eating with sinners, we are those sinners. When the church says, come unto me, many flinch. The church reflects as much of the gospel's offense as its glory. Perhaps more of the offense, yet through us, God makes his offensive call. We are that offense of the gospel. I am. And how many today reject Jesus' offer, come to me, because the church looks so offensive? We, the church, are full of sinners and hypocrites indeed. And those who say, God yes, Christians no, have a point. But God makes another. You do not understand the gospel call. To come to Christ exalted, one cannot bypass the offense, his church unglorified. Although a person can initially come to God without the church, no one can stay with God while rejecting the church. The former reflects the glory of Christ alone. The latter is a rejection of the offense. Well, that at least connects to his title.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Come hither. Christ said he was God, but the very fact that he was also a man was an offense. He had no sin, but nothing attractive either. Not to a Jewish world waiting for a powerful redeemer. That is still the case today. One cannot walk around the perimeter wall of the church trying to avoid the contamination of sinners in it as if to find another way to God. One cannot despise the body of Christ who continues to call out to his offer, come to me, and instead go to the other side of the road to avoid her. To come to Christ is to love his very messy yet not glorified bride. Jesus still says, come hither, to a world impressed by the idea of a glorified Christ, but it is a weak and all too human church who calls in his name and by his authority, come. Are you offended?
I think that it's a very unique and wonderful connection. It's very singular. He didn't give us a list of why he thinks people are saying this. He believes it's one thing. And in essence, I agree with him now that I've read through the article and I understand where he was going with this. It's just something I don't think that I've ever actually considered before, the idea that there was a pre-glorified Christ that people had to embrace or not embrace. And I haven't really thought about it fully, so it's great when people bring me an idea or an article that, you know, you can think about. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things that jumps out at my mind on a knee-jerk reaction is the fact that, or the question that comes to mind is, okay, I understand that the Jews had to trust that Jesus was the Christ before the resurrection, and that some did and some didn't, and that after the resurrection, certainly more folks did, right? Mm-hmm. So where does that leave the people who did or didn't before the resurrection? Well, we have the same on the flip side of the coin, which is Jesus prays for us who have never seen and yet believe. And so I, being in the pews at Berean as a believer, weekly getting in front of my church and saying, I believe in the resurrected Christ, I personally have never seen nor touched the resurrected Christ. So I feel just as much like one of those Jewish believers that had to believe before Christ was resurrected and never saw him as they did. Because I am in the same situation. I am telling you, I believe in something that I have never literally seen with my own eyes. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I think he does make a good point in that sense, because along the same lines, I am not perfect in my belief. This is faith. This is not sight yet. I won't have full sight until I'm in heaven with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand the connection. It's an interesting one. I'm not a big fan of silver bullets for reasons why people don't embrace the church or say things. I think that they're usually multifaceted. There's not one reason. I think this is a good explanation of what's going on in one sense. I'm not sure it's all of the explanation or why somebody would say that. You know, I think arrogance and I think selfishness certainly play a part of why someone would say, I want Jesus, but I don't want the church. But I think this is something interesting that I've never really thought about in that way.
And Jonathan, I don't know. I've never read the attributed statement that Gandhi made. But people attribute a statement to Gandhi that was, I've looked at Christianity. Basically, it was the essence of, I've looked at Christianity, and I would be a Christian if it were not for Christians. And basically looking at the way they live their life, and I think that's kind of, this article smells of that a little bit, mm-hmm. kind of thought process, is the idea of, you know, I got offended at church, so I'm not going to go back to church. And I would ask the question that's not addressed in here, do we believe a person can really love Jesus and never assemble with the bride? Never come to church? Mm-hmm. A person who, I'm not talking about shut-ins and stuff like that. I'm talking about a good, healthy, reasonable, rational person can get up Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday and go find something else to do instead of coming to the house of God and worshiping. Can we really say with any confidence that we believe they love Jesus, even though they would say, I love Jesus, it's just the church I have a problem with?
But could you even take it a step farther of being faithful to a local body?
That's what I'm talking about.
I mean, there's plenty of families that will go to church on Sunday, but they don't, you know.
They don't go to
any. It's very uncommon to have someone like Doc who's been faithful for 20-some years to one ministry, one local body.
Well, and something we could also throw in the pot is the whole reasons of why you leave a church.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people, you know, well, they'll get offended, which is what our author brings up, is, you know, are these people, they're offended about these certain things. But, you know, we've had people leave our church over the stupidest things that, really and truthfully, if they were committed to Jesus as they said they were, they would not have been a big deal.
But do they leave and go to another church, or do they leave church altogether?
Both.
So,
and I would say the ones that leave church altogether are the essence of what he's talking about.
Yeah.
For the pettiest of reasons.
Well, and I would agree with you that he's definitely talking about them, but I'm thinking about the individual that if I'm truly convinced that here at Berean, enough to join or to, you know, commit as a faithful attender, which that's a separate conversation.
What is?
Yeah. But enough to join the church the first time because of the way you teach and preach, the way you care for your individuals, if I let something small offend me, you know, like a while back we had people that threw a fuss over needing to get a little bit of a stipend for our Awana clubs. And really? I mean, at what point does your love for Jesus just overwhelm you and it's like, you know what? It's $5. And you give up on it.
And I think perhaps in just a way far above the common man way, he is saying that the reality is, if you don't love the church, if you don't love the despised Jesus as much as you love the resurrected Jesus who's coming again to give you eternal life, then you're not part of the church. And therein lies the problem. You know, don't expect people who aren't part of the church to love the church. And so the reality is, and we've discussed this probably ad nauseum, is that the fact that there are so many people on the rolls of churches all across America and literally the world who really aren't a part of the bride of Christ. And so we have this duplicit thing going on where it's difficult to tell because sometimes, in some cases, it's just hard to tell. But we certainly in this room feel like it's not hard to tell if someone says, yeah, I love Jesus, but I don't really want to hang out with Christians. Well, we have our serious doubts then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awkward moment of silence.
Yeah, I'm just trying to wrap my brain around where he's going with this because he doesn't really address the central issue, which is, are these people converted?
That's what I was saying.
Yep, I agree with you, Jack. I mean, I don't think that he agrees, and I'm not really even sure that I agree with him on the premise that they want a glorified Christ without the humble Christ, because a glorified Christ is authoritative. He's on a throne. He's the Lord. He's the boss. He's the sovereign. He's accomplished the mission the Father gave him.
He bears the scars of that mission.
He's coming back to judge the quick and the dead, to establish a kingdom. And I think in many regards, these people that have nothing to do with the local church are much more attractive to the slightly effeminate, flip-flop wearing, tender, compassionate, not judgmental Jesus who just loves everybody, is okay with all lifestyles, doesn't ever condemn the sinner, says go and sin no more, doesn't cast judgment. I'm not really sure. I think your assessment, John, with regard to a silver bullet or a single issue is spot on. I think a more appropriate article is, what are the reasons that we're finding? Why aren't they staying connected?
And I think perhaps just because of academia and just because of the circles that these things are written in, that it's always better when you find a singular answer. You will always, everybody wants a unity theory to everything, you know, string theory and all these things. We want, because if you're the guy who finds out why, the single reason why, that's, you know, that really gives you some clout. I mean, I'm the guy who figured out why, you know, this trend is this way. I mean, you talk of financial markets, anything like that, people mm-hmm. want that. But I think that so much of life, it's not necessarily like that. And I want to go back, though, because he's opened my mind to a thought that I never even thought about or considered out before, and that's this: must I really embrace the pre-risen Christ? And if I don't embrace the pre-risen Christ as the glorified Christ, am I not really truly a believer? I don't think you can separate the two. Because, look, if there's the pre-risen Christ, if he remains that way and never gets up from the dead, he's not God. You know?
Well, all I know is in Acts chapter number 2, Peter's entire focus is on the exaltation of Christ and the victory that was established through the resurrection. He doesn't take me back to this unattractive Jesus who was walking around in the days teaching and preaching. He takes me to this guy who's on the right hand. The Lord said unto my Lord, Psalm 110, he's not in the grave anymore. He's risen.
Right.
He is...
And so you would like to ask the author more, you know, what are you trying to talk about? Because if he's just trying to attack something like the prosperity gospel or the idea that people are flocking to churches and they're not really believers because they see all the benefits, it's kind of like the buffet Christianity. Okay, I'll go with you on that. Because Christ said, you know, you're going to be persecuted like I am. Christ said, it's going to be narrow is the way that, and broad is the way that, you know, narrow is the way that leads to life and broad is the way that leads to destruction. Okay, I got that piece. But this whole thing about, well, if you don't embrace the pre-glorified Christ, then you're not really a believer. I'm not sure we can even, that's hypothetical for me. Because I live after Christ rose from the dead. It's purely hypothetical and it means nothing.
And let's be honest, Peter, you're referencing Peter, makes a concerted effort in his epistle to say that it was Christ who was with Noah. And last Sunday night, when you were covering Exodus 14, you brought to us the angel of the Lord, which is Christ. So we have this eternal nature of Christ, and we're saying we trust in Christ's person and work. That means we trust in his pre-incarnate work. He created the world. Paul says that in Colossians very clearly. He's the creator of the world. He's the one who called Moses into service. He's the one who cast the horse and the rider into the sea, Brian.
Sure, sure.
He is the one who then humbles himself in the form of a servant and thought it not robbery.
Mm-hmm.
To live as what this guy is describing. Why? For the purpose of glorifying his Father through the obedience of a death on a cross, which now gives him all authority in heaven and earth, and therefore we're told to go do this and be disciples. And this concept of, you're right, John, we can't separate it, because sandwiched in between this humble servant is a pre-incarnate, powerful manifestation of God interacting in human history. And on the other side of it is the resurrected, now going to be Christ, bearing his body.
I mean, we're never seeing that humble Jesus ever again.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's here. And the only reason he was humbled was so that God's wrath could be satisfied through his obedience, so that his Father was glorified, and that his Father's creation, his creation, could be redeemed.
And think about the case with doubting Thomas.
Yeah.
What did he say? Oh, Thomas, I'm just sorry you're not going to go to heaven. No, he actually showed up to Thomas to alleviate his doubts.
Here, put your fingers right here.
Okay. Before Jesus showed up, Thomas was in the category of someone who hadn't seen the risen Christ yet and doubted whether he was alive.
Yeah. Well, look at Peter's great confession, Acts 16. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Where does that fit into the flip-flop wearing Jesus? I mean, I don't see it. I'm not sure that he made his case. And I know that's because it's desiring God. We're supposed to just fall on the throne. And
well, there's bad articles everywhere, I think.
Even there?
You know,
oh my goodness!
Incomplete thoughts. I mean, maybe.
And the Pope might not be the Pope. I mean, where does this end in your things?
Yeah, I guess my initial reading of the article, and I knew it'd be a good discussion, but I guess I didn't think as deeply as, you know, Jack and Jonathan are thinking. But I just plugged in the fact that he was kind of saying that if we believe in this humble Jesus that came and served and did all that he did before the exaltation part, I didn't really separate those two. I just more looked at the very last three words of his article, and it saying, are you offended? Like, if you are following the example of Christ, or you believe in the Christ that was humbled himself, why are you so offended at this church, at that local body? I mean, why can you not get plugged in? Why can't you serve? You know, I wrote down earlier Romans 12, and, you know, kind of tying into your first statement, Jonathan, about, you know, basically verse 3 of chapter 12 says that, for by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. And then he goes on to say, you know, we're all of one body, and we all have different functions and gifts. And, you know, I guess that was the part that I really plugged in, you know.
And I think that's his strongest point, was the fact that our church that meets, that's going to meet together on Sunday morning, is not perfect. It's not glorified yet. Mm-hmm. It is filled with sinners who, in ways we don't fully understand, we're all redeemed, but at the same time, our sin natures are not eradicated. We still can get mad at one another. We can still have issues. But I would submit to you, that is no excuse for a person who doesn't want a fellowship with a body of believers, because all throughout the world, that's the case anyway.
Yeah, and my thought, John, is that I don't really believe that this person who's disconnected from the local New Testament church but claims to have a love for Jesus, I really don't think that they're choosing the exalted Christ over the humble Christ. I think that they're creating a Jesus after their own image, so that they don't have to deal with that one or this ugly church over here, but you still placate this religious side of you, which means I love Jesus. I mean, who can say I hate Jesus? I mean, even these people that you quoted from, I like his teachings, I like what he represented. I mean, you're really hard-pressed to come right out and say, you know, it's almost like the idiot who says Jesus never existed. That's an extreme minority. So yeah, you got to do something with Jesus. So the easiest thing is create a Jesus in my own image, say I love him, and then have nothing to do with Christ or his church.
Okay, so John Stewart, comedian, mm-hmm, political guy, everything else. It was at the time of the Passion of the Christ. Right after it was given an interview kind of thing, talking about it, and said, I took my kid to see it. My kid's there. My kid turns to me in the middle of the movie and says, Dad, why are they beating Jesus? Mm. And he goes, because he loved people, and that's what organized religion does.
Wow. Yep.
That was his take from the movie.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think that's what this guy is saying, but I wouldn't say John Stewart's a believer.
Right, of course not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, that's the central issue. That's the central issue. Are these people converted?
And that's the toughest issue because, you know, you mentioned someone a moment ago who wants to create their own Jesus. I actually know people who, everything I know about these people would say that we believe in the same Jesus. They say the same things. And yet, they don't come back Sunday night. They don't come back Wednesday night. And I ask myself personally, I try to do it in a very non-judgmental way and not like to pat myself on the back, but why don't they come back on Sunday night? My only conclusion is they have decided that what they have to do is more important than that and that that is okay with God. Here's my thing. I'm not to that place yet. I can't do that. My thing is if people that I know, that I associate with, that I work for this this church and on and on, if they're going to do something together, I feel bonded with them in such a way that I want to be there.
Yep.
Even if I didn't receive a paycheck for this place, and I can say that with confidence because for years before I came to work here, I didn't receive a paycheck, and that was the way I ran my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taught that by my dad, and there's no two ways around that. So, you know, once again, it's difficult to say there's just one thing, but I just, you know, what about the person who, you know, doesn't have necessarily a different view of Jesus? I would have to say, in some senses, in some way, and this is going to sound harsh and judgmental, they're putting themselves before the assembly of God.
Well, of course they are.
And I can't say it any other way because that's just the facts. Is God okay with that? I don't know because I know it just says don't forsake the assembling of yourself. And I know it doesn't matter whether we meet on Thursday night or Sunday night or whatever. But you and I both know that there's a little bit difference on how you can count on a person like that.
Yeah.
If I call them up on the phone and say, can you do this for me? And then
there's a hemming, a hawing.
There might be less of a chance as that person that's to everything. Can I call that person up and say, hey, I need this? Okay, I'm there.
Yeah.
You know, and let's even address the parallelism that he was trying to draw. Humble Christ saying, come to me, and people are offended because he's this humble Christ. The church who now has the job of saying, come to me, is messed up because we're filled with sinners. I mean, even, you know, let's face it, a sinner opens to God's word and tries to reveal God's word to us, no matter what the church is.
Right.
And has faults.
Right.
And it's on display even more so and gets blamed even more than anybody else sitting in the pew. When it manifests, so we have this parallelism that he's trying to draw, that he's trying to put in here, and he's saying, look, you still got to come and be a part of the church. So you go back to what you're talking about Sunday night. People that don't come Sunday night, don't come Wednesday night. If they really wanted the resurrected Lord, who's the King of the universe, then even when you don't feel like going to church, you go anyways because you're commanded to gather yourself together as the man, so much more as you see the day approaching.
But they're going to say that doesn't mean Sunday night, it doesn't mean Wednesday, it just means a time of assembly, and I get to choose how often I do that. I mean, that's going to be the argument. And what do we say to them?
We say, the person who shows up to more practices gets to play in the game.
I don't care about playing in the game.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that's really where they're at, John. I mean, they're done.
Well, they do if it was their kid in soccer or something, you know. I just say that reveals something.
You have a giant percentage that trends towards non-involvement.
Yeah. Well, I think that's...
You've seen it.
Yeah. That's a
10 years ago, they were fully engaged.
But I think that's because we've lost the... Those who are faithful in much will also be rewarded with much.
Yeah, but you really have to have your head in the game to be contemplating eternal reward when I've got such good life here in America.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not talking about North Korea. We're not talking about places where life is... I mean, we're talking extreme comfort.
Yeah.
The number of people that will look at the lives we live. I mean, goodness...
We think of it as an advantage, but it's really a disadvantage.
Well, it isn't in many regards. I mean, look at our lives. I mean, who has lived like we live in the history of mankind? Mm-hmm. Instant everything, John. Hot water 24 hours a day. entertainment in our... I mean, I have a 60-inch flat-screen television in my living room. It's like theater movies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I don't have to go to the theater. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. When was the last time you chopped wood? When was the last time you had to cut the head of a chicken off in order to get chicken? Oh, yeah. When was the last time you hoed a garden in order to have green beans? I mean, when was the last time there was any legitimate effort made? And then just think about the way wages are just skyrocketing. I mean, minimum wage jobs are now becoming $10 and $11 and $12 an hour. People are going to earn $30,000 a year in America with no skill sets.
It's so ironic because there's such a disconnection from real life things on the one hand. Like, we don't do chickens anymore.
Am I wrong, Jack? No, you're not wrong.
No, we don't do chickens.
We don't do chickens. We don't have to do groceries. We go to a grocery store. We feel so disconnected from that, and yet we feel connected to the strangest things. Like, I'm personal friends with Cam Newton, and I can give you an opinion on how his quarterbacking play should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just this bizarre world we live in where these celebrities we've never met.
My team.
We feel like we're our best friends, and we are the best person in the world to comment on the last game. And if you just listen to my armchair quarterback perspective, the team would go from all losses to all wins. You know, it's this just weird world we live in.
Are you saying he's your Facebook friend?
Very strange. Very strange.
But, you know, I mean, it's just like...
He's saying Cleveland's his team.
But there's so many distractions that are like that.
Yes.
You know, like, I'm particularly looking towards the end of February for a particular sport to start racing again. You know, and Sunday afternoons, you know, I got my eye on the phone to see who's leading the race. And then what I have to do is tell my, this is ridiculous. Put that away and get ready to go to church. But you know, there's so many
distractions. That is important.
You know, so
who's leading the race is important.
Yeah. Just text Danny, he'll tell you.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, I have literally been in church because the race usually finishes up just a few minutes before rehearsal or during rehearsal. I've literally been in church and going, man, I wonder who, and as soon as I start to have that thought, I have to tell myself, you need to start thinking about what's important right
now.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. What's unique, you know, we mentioned the concept of living these lives that are, we don't even recognize that it's being a deterrent, but skipping out on more church gives you more of an opportunity to be more productive, to need less church. If I don't come back on Sunday night for church, then I can stay home and do whatever it is I need around the house. I can complete whatever honeydew projects. I can, you know, go put a few extra hours in at the office to get a little more ahead so that I feel like I need God even less.
It's true. You're right. Because if I can get caught up, then I can take a 3-day weekend and be gone for the whole weekend instead of missing just Sunday night.
Which is perhaps the biggest problem with the prosperity gospel. It leads you away from God, not towards Him.
Of course it does. Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks for joining our discussion. Not a whole lot of conclusions, but good interaction. And what do you think? What's the reason people don't come to church anymore, don't connect to church? Numbers are getting smaller and smaller. Older generations are the ones staying and out. Churches are receiving giving less and less. What's the reason for all these? Do you have a thought? Thanks for listening. Have a great day.